Welcome to the Council of Trent podcast, a production of Catholic Answers.
2 weeks ago here on the Council of Trent podcast, I did an episode on 8 unsolved mysteries that actually have been solved. We know there's nothing supernatural going on in the Bermuda Triangle. We know crop circles are actually caused by hoaxers with planks of wood, not by aliens. So what I thought would be fun today would be to talk about some of my favorite truly unsolved mysteries, which means I get to play the theme song from one of my favorite television shows growing up as a child. So, welcome to another special episode of Unsolved Mysteries on the Council of Trent podcast. Let's get into some of those unsolved mysteries then. But before I do that, I want to give a big thanks and shout out to our subscribers at TrenthornPodcast.com. You're making the podcast possible. For as little as $5 a month, you get access to bonus content, including a special thank you video from me that you can feel free to share with your friends and family. Now, on to our first unsolved mystery. This one takes place on November 22nd, 1987. It's the Max Headroom broadcast. So if you remember back in the 80s, Max Headroom was sort of this CGI TV personality. He talked in a weird distorted voice, had like a psychedelic background behind him. He was kind of an 80s personality. I think he had a TV show at one point. So on November 22nd, 1987, two Chicago television stations suffered a broadcast signal intrusion. So somebody hijacked their signal to broadcast their own broadcast. The first one was during the evening news on WGN-TV. The newscasters were talking about the Chicago Bears' 30-10 victory over the Detroit Lions, and suddenly cutting into the broadcast is a guy wearing a Max Headroom mask and sunglasses with a sheet of corrugated metal kind of bouncing from one side to the other behind him to look like the psychedelic background on the Max Headroom TV show. You couldn't hear anything in that first intrusion, and then WGN switched over the signal to go back to the broadcasters, and they said something to the effect of, that was really unexpected. That was the first intrusion on that night. Later on, I think around 11 o'clock, WTTW of Chicago got a longer signal intrusion during their broadcast of Doctor Who. And in that intrusion, you could actually hear the guy, the Max Headroom guy wearing the Max Headroom mask, speak in a distorted voice. And the clip is on YouTube. So you can go online, look up Max Headroom broadcast if you don't feel like sleeping tonight, because it's a creepy, surreal video. It looks like some guy in his garage with the corrugated metal behind him wearing the creepy mask. And this was on thousands of people's television sets. So here is the broadcast. It starts with this episode of Doctor Who, and then you'll be able to tell where the Max Headroom guy cuts in.
Stupid. You should hook up with the old ones of your tribe. That is the only way to learn.
I'll get you a hot drink, man.
So that's Max. Then here he comes. So he says, he's a frickin' nerd. He thinks I'm better than Chuck Swirsky, a frickin' liberal. Chuck Swirsky was then and is still now today a famous sports announcer. He got his break in 1979 doing a sports broadcast on 1000 AM in Chicago back in 1979. And so this was obviously a reference to him. And then the Max Headroom guy comes on, and this is a little bit more of what it sounds like. And then he picks up a Pepsi can and he says, catch the wave, and then throws the Pepsi can at the channel. And then after a few minutes, the signal cuts out and they restored the broadcast. And this is an unsolved mystery. To this day, nobody knows who the Max Headroom guy is, his identity, or the exact method that he used. We know general methods about how you can jam and intrude into broadcast signals. But to this day, he has not been caught. No one knows who the Max Headroom guy is. He faced, I think, up to like a $10,000 fine from the Federal Communications Commission. But Max Headroom is still on the loose. All right, unsolved mystery number 2, the case of the D.B. Cooper hijacking. So this took place back in, I think it was 1971. So November 24th, 1971, Thanksgiving. It was a hijacked Boeing 727. So it was a Northwest Airlines Orient 305 leaving from Portland, Oregon for Seattle, November 21st, 1971, for a half-hour trip. One of the passengers on board signs in the... He went to the ticket counter, bought his ticket in cash, and gave the name Dan Cooper. So he gets on the plane. Other passengers describe, and this is from the Wikipedia article, as a man in his mid-40s, between 5'10" and 6 feet tall. He wore a lightweight black raincoat, loafers, a dark suit, a neatly pressed white-collared shirt, a black clip-on tie, and a mother-of-pearl tie pin. So Cooper goes, takes his place on the flight. It leaves Portland at 2:50 p.m. on November 24th, 1971. And shortly after takeoff, Cooper passes a note to one of the flight attendants, Florence Schaffner. And at first, she just thought, oh, this guy's hitting on me. And she put the note in her purse or in her bag. Then Cooper goes over to her and says, you better read that note because I've got a bomb. And the note says that he's demanding $200,000 in American currency, the plane to be refueled at the airport, and four parachutes. Tina Mucklow, another flight attendant, said that Cooper, quote, seemed rather nice. He was never cruel or nasty. He was thoughtful and calm all the time. In fact, he ordered a second bourbon and water and paid his drink tab and attempted to give Schaffner the change. And he also offered to request meals for the flight crew during the refueling stop in Seattle. I think the pilots, one of the people on board, also noticed that Cooper said that they were flying over an Air Force base, and he pointed out where Tacoma, Washington was. So some of the things that he said have been built up in the profile to try to figure out who he was or what his areas of expertise were. But unlike other kidnappers or other people, he did a good job at hiding his identity by wearing these dark sunglasses, and he retrieved the ransom note that he gave to Schaffner, because previous people had been caught in hijackings or other crimes, and you take ransom notes and compare the handwriting to their signatures on military cards or social security cards. But Cooper retrieved the note and he disguised his identity. So the plane landed back at Portland. It refueled. All the passengers were let off. Five crew members were kept on board. And it took off again at 7:40 p.m. The goal was to fly to Mexico City. But Cooper asked the flight crew to set the flaps at 15 degrees and to fly at about 10,000 feet at a very slow speed, the slowest they could without stalling. And they said, well, if you have us fly at that speed, we're going to be using up a ton of fuel. We won't be able to make it all the way to Mexico City. We'll have to refuel somewhere. So he said, okay, you're going to refuel in Reno. And all this time, you know, he's got the bomb on him. So they think that when Schaffner looked in his briefcase, it looked like he had eight red cylinders. So they thought he's got a bomb. He could blow up the whole plane. When they were landing, Cooper had them draw the shades on the plane so that snipers couldn't take him out. The plane refueled, and then Cooper outlined the flight plan for them, and they started on a southeastern course towards Mexico City. At about 8 p.m., the flight crew noticed in the cabin that the aft stairs had been deployed. So on the Boeing 727, there was a rear door that could lower down, and there were steps that you could walk off of onto the tarmac. So during the flight, the aft door was lowered, and they noticed that the plane shifted. It kind of had sort of a violent swing up, so they had to trim the plane out to level it at around 8:13 p.m. Other experiments have been done by pushing a 200-pound sled off of the 727s in the same format, and it caused that same pitch. So that's how they've calculated, even though the stairs deployed at 8 o'clock, Cooper probably jumped out of the plane at 8:30. Well, Cooper, of course, is an alias. That probably isn't his real name. But in any case, Cooper probably jumped out of the plane with the reserve parachute that he was given and the money, the $200,000, probably about 8:13 p.m. Now, at this point, there were five aircraft who were trailing the Boeing 727, Orient Flight 305, but none of them saw Cooper jump out of the plane. Now, the weather conditions weren't great. There was a rainstorm. They're flying over a wilderness area. I think there was a lake and a river. None of the other planes saw Cooper jump out. So then after that, he was never found. Dan Cooper has not been found. There have been several theories about who Cooper was or is. If you go to the Wikipedia page on D.B. Cooper, there's lots of different proposed hypotheses about who Dan Cooper was. You might be saying, well, I thought it was D.B. Cooper. Now, at the beginning of the investigation, law enforcement in Oregon thought that Dan Cooper had used his real name. And so they did find a former criminal, D.B. Cooper, in the Portland area, and he was a person of interest at the beginning of the investigation, but he was cleared shortly thereafter. But that stuck in people's reporting of the event and in the public consciousness. So the name D.B. Cooper stuck for him. What actually, on the flight manifest, he just called himself Dan Cooper. In 2016, the investigation was suspended. You know, they found maybe some bits of what looked like shortly after his jump back in 1971, they found bits of what looked like parachute in the wilderness area where he would have landed. But there's no sign of Cooper and little to no sign of the money that he took with him. So there's different theories about who it was and who did that. One that I find interesting is that there was actually a copycat, Richard Floyd McCoy. So Richard Floyd McCoy actually pulled off a similar hijacking. August 7th, 1972, he boarded United Airlines Flight 855, which is another Boeing 727 with the aft stairs in Denver. He brandished a paperweight that resembled a hand grenade, demanded 4 parachutes and $500,000. After delivery of the money and the parachutes to San Francisco International Airport, McCoy ordered the aircraft back into the sky, and he bailed out over Provo, Utah. But unlike Cooper, he left behind the instructions, the hijacking instructions, the ransom note, and his fingerprints that was traced back to him. And he was arrested. So one theory is that McCoy was the original Dan Cooper, and he tried the crime again, and he was arrested. McCoy denied that he was Cooper. I will say that when you look at the picture of Richard McCoy Jr., he kind of does look like the sketches that were done of D.B. Cooper. But there appears to be evidence that he was not Cooper. He was not in Portland on November 24th, 1971, when the plane was hijacked. Lots of other people have been put forward. Some people have said that Cooper must have been a paratrooper or a special forces person because he could spot had knowledge of military facilities nearby. He knew what the plane's speed should be set at to engage in a parachute jump. Other people have said, though, that when you look at which parachute Cooper took and the conditions he went out in at the speed the aircraft was going, it was actually suicidal. So several law enforcement agents think that Cooper was not actually trained in the military, though some people say that his request for $200,000 in American currency makes it seem like he might have actually been Canadian or another nationality. I mean, if you're American, do you say, I want $1 million in American bills? You know, you and I don't say that. That Cooper was not special forces or a paratrooper, that he jumped, and the reason we never caught him or heard from him is that he didn't survive his jump, and you know, his body was eaten by animals or ended up in a river or an ocean, and it was never recovered. So that is the mystery of D.B. Cooper, still unsolved to this day. But two things that have changed. Number one, on the Boeing 727, after the Cooper hijacking, Boeing installed what's called a Cooper vane, and it prevented the aft stairs from being deployed in flight. So you couldn't just deploy them and use it as a parachute jump. Airport security was also heavily upgraded after the Cooper hijacking. I mean, there was a time when airplanes, of course, many of you don't remember this. I don't remember this, of course. I remember when things were relatively relaxed before 9/11. But there was a time you could just walk on a plane. You could have a gun in your suitcase. You could have a grenade in your pocket. You know, it was kind of like when you get on Amtrak trains today. Nobody searches you. You just get on them. You could get on planes that same way back in the 1970s. And you could smoke your Lucky Strikes wherever you wanted to. Well, or eventually only in the smoking section, you. Because, of course, it makes sense on a plane, a little metal tube in the sky, to have a smoking and a non-smoking section. But security was upgraded. It's actually, the Supreme Court reviewed it and said that airports could do universal checks for weapons, that that didn't violate the Fourth Amendment. Peepholes were added to the cockpit doors so that flight crews could keep an eye on passengers without having to actually open the doors themselves. All right, here's our next unsolved mystery. This is a short one, but definitely an interesting and weird one. It's the murder of Ken McElroy. This is the excerpt from Wikipedia. It gives you everything you need to know. Over the course of his life, McElroy was accused of dozens of felonies, including assault, child molestation, statutory rape, arson, hog and cattle rustling, and burglary. So this took place in 1981, and McElroy was kind of the town pariah, this town of Skidmore. And everybody hated this guy, and he always went to trial, but somehow he always got out of these crimes he was accused of. I mean, child molestation, rape, arson, cattle rustling, stealing people's cattle, burglary. People hated this guy, but none of the charges ever stuck. He was indicted 21 times with escape conviction each time, except for the last. In 1981, McElroy was convicted of shooting and seriously injuring the town's 70-year-old grocer, Ernest Bo Bowenkamp, the previous year. McElroy successfully appealed the conviction and was released on bond, after which, so you think this guy, you know, appealed his conviction, released, then he went on a harassment campaign against Bowenkamp and others who were sympathetic to him, including the town's Church of Christ minister. He appeared in a local bar, the D&G Tavern, armed with an M1 Garand rifle and bayonet, and threatened to kill Bowenkamp. So this is a guy who's gotten his dirty luck for almost everything, but soon his luck's about to run out. The next day, McElroy was shot to death in broad daylight as he sat with his wife Trina in his pickup truck on Skidmore's Main Street. So he went into the grocery store, bought some groceries, went out to his truck, was sitting in it, and he was shot by two different firearms. I think one was a .22 and the other was another rifle. He was shot by two different people at the same time. And it says that he was shot in front of a crowd of people estimated to be between 30 and 46. But all of the people in the crowd, so there's 30 to 46 people, at least 30 people around at this time, two separate shooters shoot McElroy in his truck. And of the dozens of people who could be witnesses, they all say they didn't see it or they were hiding. All of the residents of Skidmore conveniently did not see who shot McElroy. So this might be a case of everyone turning a blind eye to the town bully that finally got his end. So let us, of course, pray for the repose of the soul of Ken McElroy, that I don't encourage vigilante justice. And whenever we read these stories about people who have met very untimely ends, whoever they may be, we should always, of course, pray for the repose of their souls. That's what we best we do. That's what we do for everyone. Here's another one of another mysterious death. Mysterious and definitely somewhat creepy. This is the case of the Henry McCabe voicemail. This is back in September 2015 on Labor Day. 32-year-old Henry McCabe simply disappeared for several weeks in Mounds View, Minnesota, until his body was discovered in a lake. A kayaker discovered his body. The autopsy said that he had died of drowning. Now, normally, of course, this would not be that unusual of a case. This happens from time to time. But what makes it really strange is that McCabe, the night before, that night around 2 in the morning on Labor Day, he was dropped off at a gas station by one of his friends. He had been out partying, been out at a club. And later that night, his phone seemed to have pocket dialed his wife, and it left a voicemail on his wife's phone. And it's the creepiest, weirdest kind of voicemail that you hear him. He says in there, "I've been shot. I've been shot." And there's this strange animal-like growling. It doesn't even sound like an animal. It sounds like a Wookiee from Star Wars, like growling or yelling. And then eventually it stops and you hear another male voice, it's not McCabe's, say, "Stop it." And that's the end. I'm going to play you part of the voicemail now. So it can be a little disturbing, but this is the voicemail that he left his wife. So I'll play one more time. So that's a part of it. It's hard to find the actual voicemail. You can hear part of it in other news broadcasts. This is on a video where a guy puts like a little bit of like sad audio over it. And I wish he wouldn't. I wish other people would just play the audio so we can hear it and come to our own judgments. But it's weird. What in the world is it on the other end of the voicemail? Nobody can figure it out. And there's a lot that is sketchy with this. For example, McCabe's friend who dropped him off at the gas station, originally he told the police he dropped McCabe off, but at a completely different gas station. That surveillance cameras showed that he dropped him off at another location. His body was found at the lake 6 miles away. And his friend said that, oh, well, McCabe wanted me to drop him at the gas station, not at home. And he took McCabe's wallet and keys so that he wouldn't try to drive or try to buy himself more beer. So what happened? It may be the case that McCabe was just very intoxicated. He was walking in an intoxicated state for several miles, ended up falling in a lake and drowned. But then what did he encounter on that way that left this kind of sound on his voicemail? Could have been a dog. Maybe it was an animal following him. Or some people say it's Yeti, Sasquatch, or aliens. Who knows? A much grimmer and simpler hypothesis is that's the sound of like water gurgling if he fell in the lake. I don't know, but it's creepy indeed. So let's move from one that's a creepy unsolved mystery to one that's more of an esoteric and intellectual unsolved mystery. This one is called the Voynich Manuscript. According to Wikipedia, the Voynich Manuscript is an illustrated codex handwritten in an unknown writing system. The vellum, which is kind of like a leather parchment, on which it is written has been carbon dated to the early 15th century. It may have been composed in Italy during the Italian Renaissance. The manuscript is named after Wilfred Voynich, a Polish book dealer who purchased it in 1912. Though with the history of the manuscript, we've carbon dated it to the 15th century. The earliest known possessor of it was, I think it was a German monarch, Rudolf II, who bought it for 600 ducats, which is gold coins, probably be worth about $100,000 in gold today. The bulk of the text in the 240-page manuscript is written in an unknown script running left to right. Most of the characters are composed of one or two simple pen strokes. Some dispute exists as to whether certain characters are distinct, but a script of 20 to 25 characters would account for virtually all of the text. So it appears this is one of those unknown texts, undecipherable texts in the history of cryptology. So cryptology would be the study of encoding codes, decoding hidden messages. And this is one of the great mysteries among cryptologists and code breakers is the Voynich manuscript. What does the manuscript mean? Because it's 240 pages long. It's a long piece, but the text does not appear to be any known language today. And there's disputes about what kind of language it is. Those who believe it is a legitimate language say the structure of the words, it appears to have an alphabet of about 20 to 25 characters. The structure of the words seem to follow phonological or orthographic laws of some sort. For example, certain characters must appear in each word, like English vowels. Some characters never follow others. Some may be doubled or tripled, but others may not. So when you look at the manuscript and you study these characters, you know what they mean. You can, when you try to decode something, you can see, well, this appears to be a vowel, or these two letters never go together. There's rules that come to these made-up languages. There's all different kinds of made-up languages. That's one theory, is that this is not a natural language, but it's some kind of artificial language that's been constructed. I remember I met a gentleman a long time ago who was a spy. He worked for the CIA. And one of the tests you take to get into the CIA is they give you a made-up language, and your job is to try to understand it or to translate it and learn it based on comparison analysis to see if you can grasp a language and decoding very quickly. So when we look at the Voynich manuscript, another clue in it to help us figure out what it is or that there are pictures. There's pictures of plants, the zodiac, and the weirdest thing is there's pictures of nude women in baths that are connected by a series of pipes. So some of the major theories is that it's a medical text that specializes in herbal remedies, and it could have been written maybe by Roger Bacon, Giovanni Fontana. Some people say Voynich himself fabricated it, but the carbon dating really seems to count against that. Another 2006 book says that an Italian merchant, Antonio Averlino, wrote the book. So what exactly are these characters? We're not entirely sure. There's different theories. One theory is that it's a cipher, that the letters in the book stand for other letters. That's a very common, simple code technique. So in a cipher, you have a master cipher, and you would say, okay, A is represented by N, K is represented by Z. So if you have a page and it looks like a bunch of gibberish, if you have the cipher, you know to replace the N's with A's, the Z's with K's. One theory is that it's a cipher. The other, that's kind of a major theory. Another theory is that it's actually a code book, that the letters talk about how the other codes, you'll have a code, and it's a code book. It tells you to go to another book, like the Bible, for example. Go to page 27, word 3, or go to line 4, word 6, within like a Shakespearean sonnet or a certain edition of a book. This is a way that, what's the word I'm looking for here? Inmates in prison and people who have transmitted letters to one another have tried to put forward codes to communicate with each other. They'll write something, and it really tells them to go in the Bible, go to the want ads or the obituaries in a newspaper, and use that to decode it. So it could be a cipher, a code book. Could also be an Asian language. Some people have studied the linguistics involved, and it could actually be an Asian language that is being transcribed using a variant of a Latin alphabet. Because in the Voynich manuscript, there are some Latin words that can be decoded from it. There are some Latin words that are transcribed. Two other theories: that it's glossalia, it's a stream of consciousness, like speaking in tongues, that's why it doesn't make sense. Or finally, it's just a hoax. It's just random letters and there's no meaning at all. Which one is right? Well, the code breakers have to work on it to see if they can solve the mystery of the Voynich manuscript. And if you want to try your hand at Voynich keys, you could look it up online, or I think it's currently being preserved at the Yale University Library. And our last unsolved mystery, this one has somewhat of a probable explanation, but it's not completely airtight. But I love it because I love disasters and disasters at sea. I mean, I used to do a lot more of those episodes back in the day. I'll have to do a few more of them in the future. It's the sinking of the MS Munchen. What happened to this ship? December 13th, 1978. After several days at sea, the MS Munchen was a large freighter. It was a huge freighter vessel. It was the length of two football fields, and it had advanced flotation technologies to render it practically unsinkable. Haven't we heard that before? It was leaving from Germany for Savannah, Georgia, traveling through the North Atlantic, where there had been a storm brewing there since November. Now, there was bad weather, but it was nothing that the Munchen couldn't handle. The Munchen was designed to handle heavy seas. Nothing seemed that out of the ordinary for it. At around 3 a.m., some neighboring Russian and Greek vessels, and I believe the German tugboat Titan, got a Morse code distress signal from Munchen. The only thing that was decoded from it is 50 degrees starboard. Now, if that refers to the ship's list of how it was listing or tilting, 50 degrees is a very serious list for a ship to have. Even if you've ever been on a cruise ship and it lists more than 15 or 20 degrees, you're going to have cups flying off. It's going to feel very, very uncomfortable. 50 degrees starboard, the ship is near capsizing. So what happened to the ship? And then it sank. There was a large rescue operation that went out. The only thing that was retrieved from the ship was one of the lifeboats was recovered. So what happened? How could such a large ship be brought down so quickly? Well, one of the major clues was in the recovered lifeboat. One of the theories was that the Munchen was struck by a rogue wave, a wave that is much larger than other waves in this that would be in the corresponding sea. So when you look at the conditions in sea or on land, there's something called the Beaufort scale. So the Beaufort scale is a way to measure wind speed. It goes from 0, which is calm, to 12, which is hurricane force winds. And so the Munchen probably experienced a Beaufort scale maybe around 10 or 11. The waves that might have been hitting it at the highest and most severe might have been 30 or 40 feet. And the Munchen was a large vessel. If you look at pictures of it, 30-foot waves, if it's going head-on into the wave, it'd be able to ride over those. It would lap across the top of the deck, but shouldn't cause problems for the vessel. So if you want to see, this Wikipedia article on the Beaufort scale is actually really good because it shows a photo of what the ocean looks like at different parts of the Beaufort scale. So you look at Beaufort 0 through 5, you get a little bit of choppy seas, but nothing to worry about. Then there are flags, like if you go out at docks or on the ocean, there are red flags that denote the higher Beaufort scale. Triangular flags show up for 6 through 9, and that's where you see the waves starting to get really big. They could be anywhere on the lower end from 9 feet to 20 to 30 feet. And when you get up to hurricane force, which is double red and black boxes you never want to see, you can get waves that are higher than 50 feet. But that'd be if you were sailing into the middle of a hurricane with waves with winds that are over 80 miles an hour. That's not what the Munchen was in. So let's say it's hitting 30 or 40 foot waves. The hypothesis that the lifeboat that was found, the pins that would have held it to the side of Munchen were stripped off. They were stripped off by a powerful force. But this lifeboat was 66 feet above the waterline. So if a wave hit Munchen to strip the lifeboat off of it, it would have had to have been at least 70 feet, which at the time, this was in 1978, nobody thought a wave could be that big in the ocean. People have heard stories about this from mariners of monster waves that kind of come out of nowhere that are larger than the other waves around them. But nobody thought that it could have, that a wave could be in the middle of the ocean could be 70 or 80 or 100 feet tall. I mean, that just seems impossible. However, it was later proved. In 1995, a rogue wave was confirmed by measuring devices on the Dropner oil platform in the North Sea. So in 1995, the Dropner oil platform in the North Sea was in the middle of a storm, but it's a big platform. It's designed to withstand rough weather in the North Sea. And the measuring devices show that the average wave height during this storm was about 40 feet. But at one point in the storm, the devices recorded a single wave hitting Dropner that was 80 feet tall. In fact, you can look on YouTube. There's a video of a rogue wave hitting the Dunbar oil rig in the North Sea. You see it. It's about 3 minutes long. You see the waves going up, might be 20, 30 feet. And then a wave just shoots up and it touches the bottom of the oil platform, higher than all the other waves. And it's remarkable to see. It's huge. It's got to be 80, maybe 100 feet tall. So Dropner, and when they checked the instruments, they saw there was damage to the oil platform that confirmed it had been hit by one of these very, very tall waves. So what happened to Munchen, possibly? In fact, another platform in the North Sea sank under similar conditions that probably sank the Munchen. That Munchen was going into the waves, 30, 40 feet ones, not a problem. But then if a rogue wave came, that because of the hydrodynamics of the water and the wind, waves start to collapse on each other, there's an 80 or 90 foot wall of water coming at the Munchen. It would have been so large that the ship would not have cleared the trough of the wave. It couldn't have ridden over it because it's so big. It would have plowed right into it. Now, most ships are designed when a wave crashes into them, it'll exhibit maybe 15 metric tons of force per square meter. But a rogue wave could cause up to 100 metric tons of force. It could cripple the hull, but the thing that it's really going to go after, you have to worry about, if it's that high, if it's the lifeboats on Munchen were next to the bridge. The bridge was, 70 feet above the waterline. An 80-foot wave hits the bridge, it's going to smash the glass windows of the bridge. Seawater is going to get on all of the control consoles, short them out, and you're going to lose control over the ship. And once you lose control over a ship in a storm like that, the ship is going to, it's not going to be able to steer into the waves. If you're dealing with high seas, you have to go straight into the waves. If you are broadside to the waves, you're going to get rolled and you're going to get capsized, which is probably what happened to Munchen, that it lost control, listed, it was believed to have listed, maybe, drifted, for about 38, 33 hours or so, and then was eventually overtaken. Also, another bit of trivia, it's believed that a rogue wave is possibly what also sank the Edmund Fitzgerald in 1975 in Lake Superior. Those different theories about that. And there you have it, a few unsolved mysteries that truly are unsolved in one form or another. I hope you enjoyed them with me here on the Council of Trent podcast. Don't forget, if you're free this weekend, be sure to go to iTunes or Google Play, leave a review of the Council of Trent podcast. That really helps people to get to know more about us and to spread the podcast far and wide. Hope you all enjoyed this. Can't wait to share more theology and apologetics with you next week. And I hope you all have a blessed day and a very blessed weekend. Take care, guys.
If you like today's episode, become a premium subscriber at our Patreon page and get access to member-only content. For more information, visit TrentHornPodcast.com.